We have, for reasons that will soon seem obvious, saved the best for last today. And it's my pleasure to introduce a good friend of mine, Bob Greifeld, the CEO of NASDAQ OMX Group. Did I get that right, Bob? Bob, I'm on the board of NASDAQ, and Bob finds us if we don't get the name right because we've recently merged with the OMX stock market. NASDAQ OMX is a global exchange company operating on six continents now. With $23.9 trillion, almost $24 trillion in value traded on its markets, it's the world's largest exchange. It's really quite remarkable because when Bob joined the NASDAQ, it was a relatively small organization. It was owned by its members. It was barely even, it wasn't even traded on its own exchange. It was traded in the pink sheets. And over the course of the time Bob's been there, he's made it the world's leading exchange and become himself the dean of the exchange industry. Now he even, after residing in the shadow of the New York Stock Exchange for years, he now actually trades more than 20% of the New York Stock Exchange stocks himself on his own exchange. Bob has a 20-year history of in the technology world as an entrepreneur. Under his leadership, the NASDAQ has enjoyed 16 straight quarters of growth in revenues and earnings. Today, we've heard a lot about the OTC market for derivatives, particularly the CDS market, and the need for an exchange and or central clearinghouse. NASDAQ recently entered that field with the International Derivatives Clearing Group, which is a exchange for interest rate swaps, which there are, I think, $400 trillion notionally in the world today, the largest derivatives market in the world. So I hope Bob will have something interesting to say about that today because he's got one of the important solutions to the problems we've talked about today. We've also heard a lot about hedge fund regulation. Of course, we had the previous panels on that. And NASDAQ has been at the center of those discussions. They were obviously very important in the decision, for better or for worse, to stop short sales on certain financial service companies in the fall. Now will be a key participant in the new regulatory scheme. And I think Bob might have some things to say about that today, too. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Bob Greifeld. Bob, one thing I just want to say about him before he comes up, he's recently taken up golf, and I just want to assure his investors that he has very little time to practice, which his game clearly demonstrates. Welcome Bob to the podium.
Now, I have to say, though, Glenn's comments about my golf game are correct, but I played golf with him, and we're on the second hole, and I happen to quickly turn to my left or to my right, and I see the caddy kind of is rolling his eyes as he sees a shot of either you or I, because we're equally inept at it. So we'll see. But it's certainly my great pleasure to be here today. I thank Glenn and the Brookings Institute. Today, and I think for the short term, the discussions have been about economic and financial stimulus packages, and that's rightfully so. But we know that in short order, the major topic of discussion will be the reform of the regulatory regime that really has existed in this country since the 1930s. So as we contemplate the various institutions that comprise our current regulatory regime, we have to think, what are their proper roles in the future? And I, as somebody running a public company who's been involved in a number of different mergers and acquisitions, probably from a failure of imagination, think of the problem set in similar terms as any other merger and or acquisition. After you establish a defined list of objectives and responsibilities, we have to determine the competencies of the various parties and which institution on a meritocracy is really the best of breed. And as we stand here today, we believe in the fundamental premises of the Paulson Plan. We certainly see the need for a systemic risk regulator. We certainly understand very fully the need for market regulation and also a regulator concerned about investor protection. Given those as a basic belief, we see there's a natural development where the Fed takes on systemic risk, the SEC takes on responsibility and a focused responsibility for investor protection, and the CFTC and their principle-based regulation takes on responsibility for market regulation. Now, there are many complex details to be worked out, But at the first level analysis, it's quite easy and quite straightforward. The Fed today has unique expertise, which they can lever with respect to risk. The SEC is uniquely positioned to focus on investor protection. And the CFTC, through its principles-based regulation of the markets, has allowed our futures markets to really succeed and thrive on a global basis. So, at a very first pass, we see this as the structure that certainly we at NASDAQ OMX will advocate. Within the regard of investor protection, and in particular hedge fund regulation, the first point is the debate about regulation of hedge funds is really over, in that the systemic risk regulator will clearly have responsibility for all different forms of investment, and hedge funds will fall into that category. So that is a virtual certainty. And when we look at the hedge fund regulation and we look at the leverage that existed in hedge funds and people saying that is a cause of the problem of the system, the point I would make is that the leverage that the hedge funds have or had is certainly a derivative of the leverage they received from their banking sources. So in a real sense, in the new regulatory world, that problem has the ability, if you so believe it's a problem, to self-correct. Now, within the hedge fund world, we see the concept of an accredited investor, that investor who has enough financial wherewithal to essentially protect themselves. But we have witnessed in the last decade a convergence between mutual funds and hedge funds. I myself remember going back in 2008, where I received solicitations to join a mutual fund where it was a $50,000 minimum investment. And we had hedge funds coming through funds of funds where $50,000 allowed you to invest in a hedge fund. So clearly those worlds have converged, and it would be our view that the regulation of those worlds will converge. We think there is basic credibility to the concept of accredited investors having better ability to protect themselves. But when you think about yourself trying to protect your investments, clearly you need to have transparency, you need to have information, you have to know the investment strategy, and you need to know the positions and certainly the mark to markets of those positions. So as we look at the hedge fund world going forward, on the basic premise that you still have accredited investors, clearly if you want to avoid a Madoff-type situation, or if a Madoff-type situation develops, you can clearly point to the lack of rigor of the investor, then you need to bring some transparency to the LPs who invest in those hedge funds. So we certainly see that will happen. Now, with respect to a topic I do want to spend some time on today, we mentioned that if you get your hedge fund statement, clearly if it's a position that's marked on a available exchange, you know what the mark is and it's been validated by the market. But other positions will be, especially in these, some of these hedge funds will be illiquid and not available on the market, so you'll be marked to a model in a real sense. It's important you to see that. But it's also important to recognize that it is a model. As Warren Buffett described, that mark to model could be a mark to a myth. We think most of the times the models are actually fairly accurate, but certainly in the time of tails, when you're on the extreme parts of natural outcomes, they can lead you in a different direction. So this question of a mark to market or mark to a myth leads me to, back to really the credit crisis. And, how did the credit crisis happen, and how can we ensure that it never happens again? So how did we get to where we are today? The short form answer, and it's a very short form answer, is there clearly was irresponsible speculation in real estate. The speculation was enabled, multiplied, and securitized by Wall Street. And that securitization moved the asset 10 iterations away from the root investor. In another time and place, the local bank that held the mortgage understood the value of the asset. He could drive by it every day, he or she, and he understood the risk for default. Their neck was on the line. But Wall Street took this 10 iterations away risk, and the actual risk and the value was not apparent to anyone, not to the public, and I think most interestingly, not to the executives of those institutions themselves. So the question is, how did these very smart financial services CEOs make such disastrous decisions about their businesses? Did they ignore fundamental business metrics that we all rely on every day to make business decisions? Certainly, it's my viewpoint that the crucible of the problem was bad decision-making based on bad information. So then the question is, what was wrong with the information? So if we look at what has transpired, we see that throughout the economy, trillions of dollars of investments were never subject to the rigor of trading on a transparent, well-regulated market. In the absence of the market-determined price, which was, in fact, 10 iterations away from the risk, the assets were valued on a theoretical model, which turned out to be a myth, as Warren says. We had a tremendous number of these complex instruments on the books of banks and businesses where the value was opaque and ultimately was horrifically mispriced. These instruments were traded over the counter in the industry jargon, and it means they were traded between a limited number of parties with no external validation of the pricing. In the OTC world, values were distorted in a fashion not unlike the game we played as kids, such as telephone, where each step away became more unrecognizable in terms of what the risk was. And I would say to you, it might be disagreed by many, but CEOs typically are not stupid, and not all of them are greedy. And we certainly see every day that highly respected household names in the banking world came in the morning and left every day without any true concept of the true value of the assets that were on their books. The former heads of Citi, Merrill, and other institutions never got a report that says, you lost $5 billion in the market today. Never got that report. They were not traded in the market. And I would submit to you that if they had that report, their actions probably would have been different. What's interesting here, and I think it's somewhat unique, is that previous financial scandals have involved knowing financial service executives foisting inappropriate products on unknowing investors, right? That's been the normal hallmark. In this crisis, we have witnessed these financial service executives, even though they were 10 iterations away from the risk, they so believed in their mark-to-market models, they foisted these misvalued assets on their own balance sheets. First time that's happened. The other factor when we look at this credit crisis is executive compensation. I'm not commenting on the amount of the compensation. Many others will do that. But on the fact that the compensation was really paid on the interim performance, not on the completed performance of an employee. Many financial service executives were paid as if they had got over the goal line when they're in fact they were still on the 20-yard line. So the short-term nature of the compensation certainly had to be a factor that caused many executives to take action or not take action, which was the immediate advantage of themselves and their institutions, but obviously the longer-term detriment for themselves and their institutions. Now, when we think about the world that existed, and we say that if they had a compensation plan that reflected the long-term outcome of these transactions, and you had a market that showed them exactly what they're making or losing in a given way, and not through a model, we clearly would have had a different scenario, different outcome. Now, how do we move forward from here? NASDAQ, in a certain way, is uniquely positioned to comment on this and hopefully bring some positive value added to the equation. NASDAQ was formed back in 1971 and was formed as a result of the scandals that existed in the trading, the over-the-counter cash equity marketplace. We were formed to bring organization to that marketplace, to bring clearing and transparent price discovery. And as I said before, in 2008, the exchanges, the regulated markets in the world, had issues. Their issues were the volume was so heavy, heavier than we had ever foreseen. We were processing over 150,000 transactions a second for extended period of times. But each and every second we did that, every investor on the planet knew exactly what the mark was, and it was an actionable mark. They could trade against that, and they could clear against that. So we've come a long way, and through that world, we lived in a world where there were penny spreads, where investors were able to get in and out very quickly. And what we know here is that the best price discovery mechanism is where a willing buyer meets a willing seller to discover price, right? It's what the cavemen discovered and what we're learning again. A model is not a market. So clearly we have to bring some market discipline into that environment. And let's say how important this is. We are focused on the interest rate swap marketplace. We have our commercial reasons for doing it. But what's fascinating to me is that the notional value outstanding of the interest rate swap market is about $360 trillion. There is about $1.1 trillion of capital tied up with the bilateral clearing of these interest rate swap products. So in bilateral clearing, I am relying on the health of my counterparty, and I obviously have to tie up a certain amount of capital to make sure that the transaction is good. Of that $1.1 trillion of capital tied up as a result of bilateral clearing, if they move that to a central clearinghouse where there is safety in numbers, where there's soundness in numbers, the capital requirement would be reduced by about $700 billion. Happens to be a number I recollect from something else, like the TARP program. So to understand the magnitude of this, you're talking about the amount of capital that can be freed up from the balance sheet to be used for lending for other commercial activities by moving these type of instruments from a bilateral agreement where everybody has to worry about the weakest link in the chain, a la what happened with Bear Stearns or like Lehman, or to where you have safety and soundness in numbers. So certainly there's a lot of regulatory and legislative conversation about that. I think it's hard to debate it, and certainly it's our self-serving opinion, because clearly we want, you know, we're focused on the interest rate swap space, not so much the credit default space, but this is a major factor that we can do to move ourselves out. So when we look at the over-the-counter derivatives products, we clearly have to move that forward, like we moved the NASDAQ forward back in 1971. So, in conclusion and summarizing what we spoke about today, we say first and foremost, we have a new regulatory regime coming about. We have to lever the assets we have within the current regulatory regime. We need to look at it as a best-of-breed meritocracy approach to the situation. And the SEC is clear competence in investor protection as part of their innate culture. The CFTC has been a leader with respect to principle-based regulation that's allowed markets to flourish, and the Fed uniquely positioned on systemic risk. Hedge fund regulation, there'll be debates on the finer points, but there'll be no debate on systemic risk. They will be regulated. We certainly see convergence between regulation for any fund, mutual hedge fund that takes in investor assets. We'll certainly see that there'll be some differences. The concept of an accredited investor is a valid concept, but they're closer than you think, and the regulatory structure will reflect that. And the sooner we move on to getting the over-the-counter products into a regulated exchange and clearinghouse, the sooner we can have executives making proper business decisions based upon real numbers, not on theoretical numbers, and we certainly can introduce a new level of capital efficiency into the marketplace. So I thank you for your time and look forward to taking some questions. His hand up first.
Chia Chen, freelance correspondent, an observation. The session before you talked lots about regulation, and we have information that U.S. Best practice for hedge fund, and also presidential working group. I don't know the content of both. And now you mentioned about that your experience. I think with this three information, Congress is able to have enact I will call the Hedge Fund Act, and then create an agency. This could patent the OSHA Act and OSHA. That means the Occupation Safety and Health Act and the Occupation Safety and Health Administration. And this OSHA administrates safety and health of all in U.S. industry and commerce, and seems to working well. Do you think hedge fund could patent that?
Could what? Could add that?
Follow that patent.
Follow?
Yeah.
Well, I would say one thing. I think my personal feeling is that legislation should address a broad structure, and the details of how the particular industry should be regulated should be left to the agency. Because the legislative action, I think, by definition, is somewhat a blunt instrument. So I think the proper role of Congress and the President here is to set up the basic framework of regulation. As I said, we support the concept of the three main regulatory functions and give them their charter and have the agencies then work within the charter given by Congress to flesh out the details of the operations of the respective operations. With respect to OSHA, I don't have any particular comment on how that relates to hedge fund regulation. I don't really know.
Roy Kadzowitz, CPIC member, Pershing Square. I love the math you gave us on the $1.1 trillion and the $700 billion, but if the clearinghouse holds that collateral, that's $400 billion that ends up in your hands. How are counterparties protected under your vision for the clearinghouse?
Mm-hmm. That gets to do a detailed discussion. The clearinghouses have what I call a waterfall of protection. So there is member margin. There is a default fund in the clearinghouses that we see in the future. There'll be an insurance wrapper in that. So there's different constructions, but the key thing is there's X number of layers you can penetrate before you have any sort of systemic risk. And what's interesting to give praise to LCH, in the Lehman clearing, in the Lehman failure, it took a long time, and I think it could have been done quicker, but at the end of the day, the members of the clearinghouse came out clean. So the key thing that a clearinghouse does on a day-to-day basis is to manage the members' margin and under predefined rules, and to know when to make the proper margin calls and know when to cut the individual firm off of the system. So the clearinghouses have a tremendous record of not piercing the member margin. So you'll have behind the member margin probably three layers of protection within in the fund, whether it be default fund and insurance wrapper.
Is it possible that as an alternative, you'd have a tri-party arrangement where, as a clearinghouse, you'd do all the clearing functions and all the market marks, but that a third bank custodian that doesn't actually make margin decisions at all, but that are just functions of bilateral credit arrangements would work? Would that model work under your vision?
Yeah, I've heard that discussed. I said it could, but that has a lot of inefficiencies in the system. And there's something to be said to have a clearly defined margin rules that are known by the industry that applies equally to all players. And that's one of the fundamental benefits of the clearinghouse. So I see the clearinghouse model being the predominant way we go.
Neil Rowland with the Crane Business Publications. Any thoughts on the virtues of the G30 proposal last month under Paul Volcker that hedge fund regulation go beyond just registration to include regulation of leverage, capital, and risk management?
Well, first, I think the agencies should decide the proper level. And as a general comment, I would say if you start contemplating the powers required to be a systemic risk regulator, It's quite impressive or scary, depending upon your point of view. So a systemic risk regulator, if he's, that institution is going to fulfill its role, will have more pervasive, far-reaching powers than we've ever given to any regulatory body. Because, you know, by definition, it has to be a principles-based approach to systemic risk, and you have to be able to walk into any institution you think is necessary. So hedge funds will fall under that orbit. There's no two ways about it. With respect to some of the details of how you'll regulate hedge funds, you know, my comments were more from the investor point of view, as coming in the post-Madoff scandal. If you're going to be an accredited investor looking at a hedge fund investment, you have to have transparency of the investment strategy, you have to have transparency of the positions and the marks on a periodic basis to make an informed decision. And clearly the funds of funds were supposed to do that. With respect to leverage, I believe that the leverage in hedge funds sooner or later will have some regulatory aspect to it. It would be my personal feeling. But I'm also keenly aware that lacking banking support, the leverage issue basically self-corrects, or it's a derivative of the bank leverage. So to the extent the banks are less leveraged, then the hedge funds will be less leveraged also. But if I was to make a prediction, I would say there will be regulation on that in the years to come.
Would you want to take one more?
Sure.
Thanks for coming. I think you're at a very special vantage point. From what you can see, what are the potential downside to this crisis, and what do you worry about? What do you really worry about at this point?
The downside to this crisis? I think we...
What do you not worry about?
I know. I think we live it every day, certainly from the downside of the crisis. I mean, clearly... In our direct business model, there were essentially no IPOs in 2008, and it's looking to be that way in 2009. And it's interesting that from our accounting treatment, we treat IPOs revenue over 6 years. We have to recognize the revenue over 6 years, so you're building an increasing headwind. And I look at it the same way in the economy, right? So the lack of IPOs in a given year doesn't directly impact the GDP or the growth rate, but it compounds upon itself. So we'll have a time to work out of the, this headwind that we've developed, even when we're post-recovery, since we're missing these years of growth. I mean, we have now two lost years, not talking about a lost decade, but two lost years, certainly with respect to new business formations, raising capital, and be able to grow in a rapid fashion. So we'll feel that for a period of time. But I certainly think, like many, there's opportunities in this type of crisis. And when you look at this derivatives world, it has done many good things in the financial services arena. It has certainly allowed us to mitigate risk. When we get the market structure right and people have real markets and real clearinghouse, then we'll be in a fundamentally stronger place. And the regulatory regime, it was always curious to me that the 1930s were where all wisdom was gained. So it's been a long time ago. So for us to craft a forward-looking regulatory regime will be a clear positive to us in the decades to come.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that concludes our forum. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for our sponsors. Thank you to Gordon, who led the way in organizing this, and the support staff here at Brookings that made it all possible. So thank you all for coming, and I think it's been a great session.